So we were lucky to have caught him before he departed. Thank you.
Thanks. So I work in the main campus at Columbia. So this is a view from our building south, Broadway, the Hudson, Midtown. I lead a group of people as you know, science nowadays is done always in teams as a collaboration. And our group of people has one passion, which is to understand how the cerebral cortex works. So as you may know, the cerebral cortex is the largest part of the brain in mammals. It's a thin strip of tissues, about 2 millimeters thick, and it covers the encephalon. So everything that you see here, essentially this is all the cerebral cortex, and this is the cerebellum. This is a cross-section through the human brain, and you can see the cerebral cortex right here. Cortex means bark in Latin, and if you were to take it out of the human brain and spread out flat, it would be about 2 square meters, just about a little bigger than this table. So the cortex is interesting. The reason we're passionate about it is that we know now for a while, because of the study of neurological patients, that the cortex is the site of all our mental abilities. So our intelligence, our perception, motor planning, imagination, speech, all of these things are performed by this tissue, okay? So it's the physical basis of what hits our minds. So at the same time also we know, if you're interested in the clinical side, that the cortex is also the site and it's affected in all the mental diseases and many neurological diseases. So the heart of psychiatry and neurology are diseases that affect the cortex. At the same time, we don't understand how the cortex works. So this is a time in history, as Sam has mentioned, where medicine has made great advances in the last centuries, understanding different parts of the body, but we've reached the brain, and that's still terra incognita. No, we don't have a general idea of what is it that goes on in the cortex, how does these cortical circuits compute. The cortex is actually, if you took a section through this region, you would see something like that. It's built out of layers of neurons. So these are the 2 millimeters that stretch from the white matter, here to the pial surface and under the skull. And these are little neurons that are arranged in layers, thousands of them. And if you took an even closer look at them, they look like this. So these are an example of drawings of neurons from the cortex. Most of the neurons they're called pyramidal cells. They're excitatory neurons. They have glutamate as the neurotransmitter, and they have a dendrite which stretches all the way to the tip of the cortex, and then a skirt of basal dendrites around the cell body. This is the cell body, and then they have an axon. And as you know, the dendrite is the input side of the neuron, so all the inputs into the neuron go to dendrites, and the axon is the output side of the neuron. So most of the neurons in the cortex look like this. And some look a little bit different, and they have inhibitory transmission. They secrete GABA. And between this mixture of excitatory cells and inhibitory cells, connected in patterns that we don't understand, out of this structure emerges the mind, and essentially this is what makes us what we are. So So it's going to be a historic time for mankind when science and medicine reaches the cortex and cracks it and comes up with a scientific understanding from the inside of our minds. And when that happens, the prediction is that our culture is going to change, because we will be able to actually finally understand why we do what we do, understand behavior. Hopefully this will make us free, more free. And we will also be able to tackle all these diseases, which right now in psychiatry and most branches of neurology, in spite of the heroic efforts of all these clinicians, we still treat patients with symptomatic treatments without understanding the underlying cause of the disease. So we cannot cure these diseases because we don't understand how the machine works. It's like a car. You cannot fix the car because you don't know how it works. So this is going to happen sooner or later. And it's going to be, again, a historic time, a turning point in the in our history. And from that point on, it will have wide repercussions in our culture, in our medicine, and also in the technology, because it's very likely that the cortex is computing with strategies that are still inaccessible to science and engineering. That's why we do what we do. It's the most interesting thing in the world for many of us. We cannot understand doing anything else. Although I have to tell you that a few years ago I was reading a report in the newspaper that the concentration of CO2 in the atmosphere went above 400 parts per million. And then I said, well, maybe someone should fix that problem first before we can fix this one. Because we may not have enough time. Anyway, so so people like me, I was trained in medicine. After having experience trying to treat psychiatric patients, schizophrenics, which is essentially hopeless, I decided that we're not going to be able to figure this out until we understand the basic problem. So I switched to basic research. I came to the U.S. and I've been working on understanding the circuits of the cerebral cortex in mammalian preparations, particularly in mice. So why do we study mice? Well, it turns out that the cortex has a very interesting evolution. It's appeared relatively recently, and it's spread out, grown tremendously in size through the mammalian lineage, to the point that in the case of human, we have as much cortex as we can fit inside our skull. Inside the cortex is sort of crumbled up. And they say that one of the limiting factors in human evolution, the reason we cannot have a larger cortex is because we cannot have a larger brain because of the size of the female pelvis. You couldn't be born through that narrow channel. So evolution is found out a trick to build this cortical tissue in the mammalian lineage, and as soon as it found out, it essentially increased it as fast as possible. So it's very suggestive of the possibility that we're dealing with a case of essentially duplication of a body plan, just like it happens in development, the way that the bodies are built with segments and the segments are repeated. So somehow the central hypothesis of our field is that we're dealing with some sort of circuit module, a little piece of cortex that would look like this. Maybe it would have 10,000 neurons, and that evolution figured out how to make that, and then is repeating it over and over. And if this is the case, this is the idea that the cortex is built out of these modules, this scalable architecture. If this is the case, then these modules will be the same in mice and in humans. And the reason why humans are more mentally capable is because we have more of these modules. Maybe humans have about a million of these modules, and mice may only have just about 1,000. So that means that if we can understand how a module of the cortex works in any mammal, we may be able to unlock the secrets of the success of mammalian evolution, why mammals have conquered the world, and in particular, the underpinnings of our minds. So this is the reason why many of us drop everything that we're doing and just jump in and try to help mankind in this fundamental problem. So again, the central hypothesis that we're doing some sort of module that is repeated. No one knows how the module looks like. This is a hypothesis, hasn't been demonstrated. But it turns out that if you look at the human cortex, different parts of the cortex are used for completely different functions, for different computations. So if you go to the back of the cortex in the occipital lobe, so that's used for some sort of visual image processing of the world. We use it to see. No? And then you go to the front of the cortex, the prefrontal cortex. It's unclear what it does, but people think that it may have to do with calculating the probability of future events, some sort of calculator of Bayesian probabilities. And then you go to the lateral side of the cortex, and there are areas that are decoding speech. And there are other areas that are actually involved in generating motor patterns. So all these computations apparently have nothing in common. They're very different as they can be. Yet, they are generated with the same hardware. So the cortex looks the same. If you go to the back of the cortex or the front of the cortex, it looks pretty much the same. There's no fundamental difference, at least superficially. No? So that means that the same hardware, the same chip, or the same module can be used to solve all these types of problems. So this has triggered the idea that we could be dealing with some sort of universal computer, with a circuit that evolution has built that can be used to solve any problem. So this is the idea of a Turing machine. That a Turing machine is a computer that can compute anything that can be computed. And the Turing machine was the foundation of the modern digital revolution, the computer revolution. Well, this could be some sort of biological equivalent of a Turing machine. Because of these different computations are apparently so different, the common denominator of them has to be very simple. So many people argued, well, we cannot understand the brain because it's too complicated, or we cannot understand the cerebral cortex. But my hunch is that it's not because it's too complicated, because it's going to be very simple, just like the DNA double helix was a very simple model that explained as the common denominator of all the genetic inheritance and all the phenotypic variations of animals. So it's all buried in this very simple model. So somewhere in these impenetrable jungles that people have talked about of the cortex lies some sort of simple structure which like a double helix. It's not going to look like a double helix, obviously, but it will be some sort of neural circuit built up with connections of neurons that is used to compute something fundamental that you can use as a basis of a biological Turing machine. Okay, so if this is so simple, how come neurobiologists haven't figured this out? They've been trying to understand the cortex now for 100 years. It's been generation after generation all over the world as part of a joint effort. We fail. We haven't come up with a general theory, a theory that could explain what happens in the cortex, how does it work, and a theory that we could use to predict in the future and also to cure diseases. Now, that would be a good definition of, if you understand an organ, is you can actually cure the problems that it has. Now, so we haven't come up with this yet. Part of the problem has been the fact that neurobiologists have used methods to understand how neurons work that are based on electrical recordings. So this is an example of one of these neurons from the cerebral cortex. In this case, it's from a cat. This is a pyramidal cell. And this is an electrode, which is a tungsten shaft that is coated, insulated, except for the very tip. And you drive these electrodes inside the brain of animals or people, and you bring it very close to the membrane of the cell body of the neuron, and then you can electrically record the action potentials, the firing pattern of the neuron. So you can use these electrodes as little microphones to hear the activity of individual neurons in the brain of a living animal. And this technique has been the workhorse of neuroscientists over the last 100 years. And a lot of what we've learned about how the brain works, or the little that we've learned about how the brain works, has come out of recordings from this type of electrical measurements. So now I wanted you to do the following thought experiment. Imagine that you're an extraterrestrial scientist or extraterrestrial science teacher, okay, and you land in New York City and you see this. And you say, wow, what the hell is that? Let me try to understand how it works. I'm just curious. I'd like to find out what is this and what is it used for. And as a good scientist, you won't take it apart into its individual elements. And you find out that the Empire State Building is made out of atoms. And then from that point on, you said, okay, I got it. I'm going to study the atomic structure of the Empire State Building. And no matter how much time you spend on it, you will never understand how the building works. You will find a lot of things about the atoms, but you will not get the point that this is a building that has a function. And the reason is because the function of the building is an emergent property. And it's a property that is written not at the level of the atoms, but at the level of the architectural floor plans and how people interact with them. So you have to lift your view from the atomic structure, that atoms build bricks, and you have to lift your view from the bricks. And only when you start looking at the floor plans and then see how people interact with them, you finally get that this is a building, that this is used for offices, that there's some weird thing going on the top, people coming in and out. But that's when you will actually get it. And this is a classical example of something that in science is known as an emergent property. An emergent property is a property of a system that by definition is not present in the individual components. And it only occurs or emerges out of the interaction between particles. Okay, so in physics and in chemistry and in other fields of biology, the world is full of emergent properties. You have systems, for instance, this table is solid, yet it's made out of atoms, yet the force of my finger pushing through it is much stronger than the force of any atom. So how come my finger doesn't go through the table? That's an emergent property, solidity. Because the interaction between atoms is such, and this is actually a not trivial part of physics, that generates some sort of resistance which depends not on the individual atoms but on their interactions. So by interacting together, matter takes properties that don't happen in the individual particles. So now let's go back to the cortex. If you look at any piece of the cortex from any animal, you'll see something like this. This is the primary visual cortex of a mouse. This is now a living brain slice of the mouse cortex. This is the pial surface, so the skull will be up here and the white matter over here. And every one of these white dots is a neuron. So you see the palisades of neurons. The primary visual cortex of the mouse has about 180,000 neurons. These neurons, each of them, connects with about 10,000 other neurons and receives connection from thousands of neurons. So this system is built to interact. In fact, the more connections a neuron makes, the less important it becomes. Like a gigantic democracy, you can take out a neuron out of this group and probably nothing will happen. So if you think about that, and then think what neurobiologists have been doing over the last century, then you understand why we haven't figured this out. Because what we've been doing is we've been sticking an electrode in an animal and recording from one neuron in one animal, and then comparing that recording with another neuron in another animal, and doing that over and over again. So we've really been looking at the atomic structure of the building, so to speak, without realizing that all of these neurons are interconnected and they're all firing together, building complicated patterns. This is the idea that in order to understand the cortex, the neural circuits, we need to have techniques that enable us to access this emergent level of function. So if we try to do it with electrodes, you can put one electrode, okay? And we go for 1 year, and I say, okay, let me try to put a few more electrodes. But it just gets pretty ridiculous. Now, you're not going to be able to stick electrodes to recover from the neurons. You'll turn the brain into a Swiss cheese. Well, people have come up with other methods, and you may have heard of functional MRI, which is a technique that scans the brains of patients and looks at the hemodynamic changes in blood flow across these voxels in different pieces of the brain. And when there is brain activity, the blood flow into that area increases, and you can pick this up magnetically if you look at hemoglobin, and you can put a little red dot in the area that was active. So with these brain imaging techniques, you can look at the activity of the whole brain. But unfortunately, you don't have enough resolution. You cannot see the neurons. Each of these voxels is about 50 to 100,000 neurons. And on top of that, this technique has very slow time resolution. You don't look at neuronal activity. You look at blood flow. And the blood increases after the neural activity has happened. The resolution of these movies is very slow, seconds. Neural activity happens in a millisecond timescale. So this is very useful, but it's not going to bring home the bacon. It's not the type of tool that we need to understand in detail this emergent level system. So with these thoughts, a group of us proposed the idea of a large-scale scientific project, which we call the Brain Activity Map. The group behind this proposal was a mixture of scientists, many of which came from outside neuroscience or biology. People coming from the physical sciences, people that were used to deal with emergent systems, and people who also used to build new tools, new types of technology. So it's a combination of researchers from physics, chemistry, engineering, and then of course also neuroscience and genomics. And genomics was interesting because we copied the model of the Human Genome Project. You know, the Human Genome Project was a technology development project that lasted 15 years. In which teams of scientists were put together to work with a common goal of inventing new techniques to sequence the entire human genome. And at the beginning, everyone thought this was crazy, but it happened. It actually happened before the ahead of time. And this happened through the generation of groups of people that worked in these big centers. So this is an example of what you could call big science that has been around in physics and chemistry and astronomy now for 60 years or so. You have a particle accelerator where teams of physicists work together, or chemists work together, or astronomers at their telescopes. So the Human Genome Center was the first time that big science happened in biology. And the effects were revolutionary. First of all, they created a technology, which, by the way, the final technology that was used for sequencing of the human genome was not even imagined at the beginning of the project. It was a little bit like a moonshot type of project that galvanized the community. And then it also enabled not just a revolution in our understanding of the basic biology of how the genomes function, but also revolutionized medicine. So areas like cancer, for instance, nowadays are completely changed by the access of this genome sequencing. We are entering the world of personalized medicine because of the Human Genome Project. So very soon, when you go to the doctor, maybe in 5 years, they will just sequence your whole genome. When you take a blood test, they will just have the entire genome, and they will be able to search with computers what are your risk factors for particular diseases. So this is going to happen. This is happening right now. So, and then the other thing that was very interesting for the Human Genome Project is that it actually spurred an enormous development of entire technology which is the biotech or, genomics, which has been calculated that for every dollar that the U.S. government spent in the basic science of the Human Genome Project, 15 years later, the economy has had a return of $140. So there's been an investment of $1, or $140 for every dollar, 15 years later. So this was actually, it wasn't expected, it was a gigantic boom to the economy. So we thought that maybe now is a good time to do something like this for neuroscience and create tools to map the activity of brains so that we can actually look at the activity of entire neural circuits and try to tackle this problem of the emergent properties of brain function. So our proposal was a series of white papers that we sent to different organizations, and they ended up in the hands of the White House in the Office of Science and Technology, and who independently were looking for a large scientific project that they could use as a banner to stimulate funding and excitement for science. And they adopted our project. President Obama changed the name from Brain Activity Map to the Brain Initiative because he's the president, he can do that. And he also sold it to Congress from the angle not just of basic science or medicine, but from the angle of the economy. He said, well, if we want the U.S. to maintain its economic leadership in the world, we have to invent new fields. And just like we did in the case of genomics, we can do the same thing for neuroscience. And the money that we will spend today could have a big return a decade or two decades from now. This was the main argument that he made in the State of the Union address a year ago. So, more specifically, our proposal is to build tools, to create the technology that we lack. And there's two types of tools. The first goal is to create tools to measure the activity of every neuron in a complete neural circuit. Okay, what do we mean by a complete neural circuit? So you can take an animal like a worm that has a few hundred neurons and try to measure the activity of every neuron in the worm while the animal is behaving. If you could do that, you can actually hope to crack the code underlying the behavior of the animal. And just like in the Human Genome Project, where they started small and marched their way up through the animal kingdom, we could start with worms, we could then graduate to flies, have slightly bigger brains, and try to develop tools to map the activity of all the neurons in the fly, and then go up to fish, to a vertebrate, and eventually to a mouse, and maybe at some point we can apply these techniques to the human. Now, I wouldn't necessarily argue that we will map the activity of every neuron in the human brain, but maybe we could map the activity of every neuron in a piece of a human brain, let's say in an epileptic patient or a schizophrenic, where there's direct medical information that needs to be obtained from these patients. So this is our first goal, to develop the tools to do this mapping, but mapping by itself is not so powerful. As scientists, engineers, or clinicians, we need a way to alter the system that we're studying so that we can test hypotheses about how it works, and so that we can also cure the diseases of the malfunctioning of these neural circuits. And because of that, our second goal is to develop tools to alter that activity, to be able to manipulate, if you wish, the function of the circuits, again, on animals and all the way up to people. And of course, this is done in the spirit of helping mankind, helping all these devastating diseases. But this technology is going to be very powerful, and it could be used to read the minds of people. If we can break the code to see what this fine pattern means, we may be able to understand what the animal or the person is thinking. And if we can change that activity, we may be able to change the way the animal or the person is thinking. So because of that, we think that this technology is so important, it has to be developed by the public. It should be a public effort, and it should also be overseen by ethical panels where you have representatives, not just of the scientists, but also representative of the society, of the citizenship, and experts in the legal profession, and experts in all the aspects of human life, because they are going to be profoundly altered by these technologies. So this has to be a controlled development of technology that should be under at least some supervision by these ethical panels. This was, by the way, endorsed by Obama when he announced the Brain Initiative. So there's an ethical panel that actually oversees the development of this technology. And then we did have a third goal, which is to also develop tools not just to measure and alter brain activity, but to interpret brain activity, because the amounts of data that are going to come out of this initiative are going to be enormous. And just like in the Human Genome Project, they had to develop entire tools to mine that data and to store that data and display it. We're going to have to do the same thing with this brain data. So these are the three thrusts of the brain activity map, again, which became the Brain Initiative. And I'm going to give you a little bit of an inkling of what we have in mind as appetizers of what you could be seeing in the future. So this, by the way, has been launched last year by the White House. It's supposed to be a 12-year project. The first year to get it started, the White House invested $100 million, but this investment is going to be ramped up. So we'll approach the same level of funding that the Human Genome had, which was about $3-4 billion over the decade. So this is going to be a massive amount of funding that is going to have probably a transformational effect, not just in neuroscience, but also in medicine and also probably in the technology. So let me give you an example of what the types of things that are done. So the first goal, how can you measure the activity of every neuron in a neural circuit? So I told Wordy that you cannot just go ahead and stick an electrode there. Let me give you an example of how you can do it now, or how you can start to do it. And these examples will also have been chosen to prove to you how the solution for these problems are interdisciplinary solutions. They lie out of the fields, in this case of neuroscience, and they come from other fields of science. So this also beautifully shows the unity of science and how scientists work together across disciplines. In this case, the solution to measure the activity of every neuron, at least the best solution we have today, comes from organic chemists. So organic chemists who didn't care about the brain, they were interested in building molecules that bind ions like calcium with high affinity. So this is an example of one of these chromophores that binds calcium through this open bonds. And when calcium binds, it changes the electronic structure of this molecule and it changes the fluorescent properties that it has, which means that you can actually use light to optically interrogate what is the concentration of calcium in a cuvette. Or you can do that inside a cell. Okay. And it turns out that if you look at the calcium concentration inside a neuron, this is the intracellular free calcium, if you label the neurons with these calcium indicators, whenever the neuron fires, these calcium channels open up, calcium comes into the cell, which means that if you monitor with fluorescence the calcium concentration as we're doing here, this is the fluorescent intensity versus time, and this is the electrical activity versus time. This is a neuron in which we have an electrode, and we're also measuring calcium with these calcium indicators. And you can see that whenever the neuron fires, the membrane potential becomes depolarized. There's a little blip in the calcium concentration. You can detect the firing of the neuron by looking at the changes in intracellular free calcium. So this is an optical method that comes out of chemistry that is used now by neurobiologists to measure the activity of neural circuits, because you can use ways to put these indicators, these calcium indicators, inside the brain of living mice, like within here. And then you can use microscopes, laser scanning microscopes, to look into the brains of these mice. So here you have a mouse that is awake. His head is fixed to a post that's attached to the microscope. The mouse is running on this trackball so that he can run, but his head can still be fixed. And then the mouse is looking at a screen where we're showing some visual stimulation. Simultaneously, this mouse has been, the neurons in its visual cortex have been stained with these calcium indicators. So every one of these white dots is a neuron that is expressing this calcium indicator. And when you see this movie taken with a two-photon microscope, when the neurons flash, it's because they have action potential. So here we can monitor the activity of, let's say, a couple of hundred neurons in the brain of the mouse, in the visual cortex of the mouse, while the animal is awake and is looking at its screen and is behaving. This is the analysis of that movie where we color in red the neurons that are active. So this is about 10 minutes in the life of the brain, of this piece of the brain, of the cortex of this mouse. So this is the types of things that we can do today. We can look at the cortex of the mouse, we can image the activity of 200 neurons, and we track them, track their firing as the animal is performing some sort of behavior. No? The idea is to get better at this, so that instead of imaging a few hundred neurons, we can image a few hundred thousand neurons. Instead of imaging these things in two dimensions, we could do it in three dimensions simultaneously, acquiring a whole tissue worth of data. And instead of doing this in mice, at some point we could try to do this in humans. So how could you do this in a human patient? Well, this is the microscope that we use to take that mouse movie. It's a big optical table, 8 feet by 4 feet. It has a lot of complicated lasers, optics. It requires a team of engineers, optical physicists, neurobiologists working together. But it turns out that their efforts are ongoing to miniaturize these types of microscopes into little devices that you may be able to, this has been built already, that you may be able to put on top of a skull of a human patient. And this could be a wearable microscope even. And there may be ways to get this data out, so you could take movies like the one I showed you, maybe 5-10 years from now, from a human. And then you would have access to that information and be able to actually use that information to help the person. How could you use that information to help the patient, the person? Let me just show you an example of what we do today. So this is now a paralyzed patient who has implanted electrodes in her frontal cortex. In this case, she has just about 5 or 6 electrodes. And these electrodes are recording the activity of 5 or 6 neurons. And this activity is sent to the computer, which is connected to this robotic arm. And by thinking, she's moving the arm. This is called a brain-computer interface. And in this video, she's been paralyzed for 20 years, and this is the first time she's been able to take a CPAP by herself. By training the computer with her thoughts. When she thinks particular thoughts, particular neurons fire, and she can eventually, the computer learns to recognize this, and she can teach the computer to move the arm. So this is what we can do today. Look at her happiness after she's achieved this. Imagine what this woman could do if instead of measuring the activity of a few neurons, we could measure the activity of a few hundreds or a few thousand neurons, maybe through an optical method. Maybe this woman would be able to not just have a drink from a sippy cup, but be able to have a relatively normal life. Maybe walk with an assisted exoskeleton or drive a car and incorporate herself to society, you know, have a more normal life. We will liberate the patients like this from their tyranny. You know? This is an example of the medical applications, which in this case is very, very direct, of the developing this technology. Let me just give you an idea of how about technologies to change the activity of neurons, to manipulate or alter the activity of individual neurons. How could you do that? Well, in this case, one solution could come out of chemistry, but in this case it's not organic chemists, but inorganic chemists. So this is actually a very interesting story. So inorganic chemists, one of the big challenges there is to build better solar antennas, solar cells, because the solar cells that we have right now are only 30% efficient. So if you could break through that barrier and make a solar cell that was 50% efficient, 80% efficient, you would solve the energy problem for the world forever. No? So this is a big deal, and they could just solve also the CO2 emission problem. So these are really smart people working very hard, and they came up with the idea of using the metal ruthenium. Ruthenium is a metal that you can derivatize it to build solar antennas. It turns out that it's extremely efficient at catching the photons from the sun. And about 10 years ago, the inorganic chemists were saying, well, we're going to solve the energy problem in the world with ruthenium light antennas, with ruthenium solar cells. But they found out that when the light hits these light antennas, they break apart. Okay, so it's terrible for a light solar cell because you can only use it once. But one of the chemists involved in this research thought, well, maybe this could be good for the neuroscientists because we can use these light antennas, couple it through the metal bond to a neurotransmitter. In this case, it's glutamate, the same excitatory neurotransmitter I was talking about. And then you can, when glutamate is coupled to this light antenna, it's inactive. It doesn't do anything because it cannot diffuse. It's trapped. It's actually a cage. This is a chemical cage. It doesn't look like a cage, but it acts effectively like a cage. But then when you hit it with light, you break this compound, the light antenna, and then the glutamate is free, and then it becomes active. So this is a way to do optochemistry. You can use light to photo release this chemical. And if you do that in the middle of the brain, in this experiment, we have one of these pyramidal neurons. It's been incubated with this glutamate cage. And then this is the electrical recording of the cell. And when we open the laser and hit it with light, we break these bonds and we make the neuron fire. So we can go there with our laser and make this neuron fire, but not this neuron specifically. We can make you have single cell resolution, pinpointing the neuron that we want to fire. This is an example of, again, the impact of inorganic chemists into modern neuroscience. So you can build these light antennas with glutamate, and we've also built them with GABA, with the inhibitory transmitter. And how is this going to be useful for mankind? Well, let me give you an example of an experiment that we did last year in collaboration with Steve Rothman in Minnesota. This is the GABA light antenna. This is the ruthenium with the GABA. And then when you hit it with light, you release GABA. Well, here we have an experiment which has a rat which is epileptic. And these are recordings from the cortex of this animal. And these recordings are the electrographic seizures, which look very similar to the ones that you see in many human patients. So this is a typical pattern. They call it polyspikes. And the poor rat is having these seizures continuously. We incubate the cortex of the animal with this ruthenium GABA light antenna. And then when we turn the light, we can stop the seizures for a few minutes. Okay. So this is a way in which you can actually stop an epileptic seizure by using this clever chemistry and using an optical method.
Why does it start up again?
This light pulse is very brief and only broke a few molecules. So the amount of GABA that's floating there is very small, and then eventually it gets drained out by the circulatory system, and then you don't have any more GABA left. But let's say, imagine they have a patient. You know, epilepsy is a big problem. It's an example of these diseases that could use help from science and clinicians. So 1% of mankind is epileptic. And out of those patients, about 40% of them don't respond to any treatment. And the only solution for many of those patients that have chronic epilepsy that doesn't respond to treatment is neurosurgery. So in all hospitals, many hospitals, including this one, every day there's epileptic patients that go into the surgery room, and the surgeon takes out a piece of brain. And if you think about it, it's pretty brutal. I mean, this is equivalent to having a bacterial infection on your finger, and you don't have antibiotics, or you don't even know what's a bacteria, and you just chop off the finger or the arm. So this is what we're doing today to many of these patients all throughout the world, in the best universities in the country. So imagine one of these patients in the future, okay, that has this chronic epilepsy, doesn't respond, takes one of these pills that has this cage molecule, and carries in his pocket a very bright light source. There's now LEDs that are plastic LEDs that are super bright, and they can go through the skull. So this patient is going to have a seizure. You know, many of these patients, you can actually, they can intuit when the seizure is going to come. They have an aura, and they pulls out the flashlight and flashes himself a few times in the area where the seizure is going to come, and then continues his normal life. You could do that, or imagine the patient wearing a helmet in which the seizure is automatically detected and automatically solved. So this could be optomedicine. Some of the treatment of these neurological patients in the future, or psychiatric patients. Imagine that instead of an epileptic, it's a schizophrenic that has schizoid attacks, and there's an optical way to stop that. So I'm just going to wrap up. Why we think it's a good idea to do this large brain project? So I was giving you the scientific rationale, the curiosity of scientists like us who say, well, let's just understand how this works, and maybe we need to understand this emergent level property. So this is the basic point. Can we one day look at the entire picture of the activity of a whole piece of brain and decipher what's there? Can we break the code? No. Can we decode the activity? The medical goals, I've given you a couple of examples, to develop new assays for brain diseases so that you can actually study these diseases much better, understand what's wrong with them. Maybe there are emergent diseases, so you need an emergent hypothesis, so to speak, and develop novel therapies using optical methods, for example, or brain-computer interfaces. And then there's the economical benefits to the country, to the world, in terms of opening up a new field of economic development, just like in the Human Genome Project. And finally, to train a new generation of scientists who will be interdisciplinary, who will be at home, at ease, both in the biological sciences and in the physical sciences, that will switch back and forth. This is something that we lack today, and it's a major block to our progress, because it doesn't matter if we have great ideas and a lot of money, if we don't have the people that can think like this, that can go back and forth between inorganic chemistry, solar cells, neurobiology, patients. We need people that can do the whole loop, and these are not us. We're too late, too old. After it's the younger generation that we have to train, or you have to train, to think broadly without outside the boundaries of the disciplines. So let me just finish with how this could happen. So we were involved in launching this project, which is now in the hands of the NIH, NSF, DARPA, and other federal organizations overseen by the White House. Again, this is going to take on, no, it's already taken off, but it will last for more than a decade. There are private foundations who were essential in helping us launch this initiative with their support, both their small financial support, but particularly the moral support and the connections that enable us to reach the right people. And this foundation could continue to serve to spur the development of this initiative. And then we hope that the industry will see the light and will understand that they have a lot to gain from this type of work being successful, just like in the Human Genome Project, and they will get involved in picking up the shovel and helping with the effort. And my last slide is one of my mentor, Brenner, who argued that progress in science depends on new techniques, new discoveries, and new ideas, probably in that order. And this is a little bit of a slap in the face to most scientists who think that they're very clever and we come up with a hypothesis and then we have a great idea and then we test it and then we put it right and we move on. In reality, everyone is very clever and we're not more clever than the people that came before us. There have been 100 years of very clever neuroscientists working on this problem of the cortex, and the reason they haven't figured it out is not because they lack intelligence or hard work, but because they lack the tools. So you can only see as far as your tools. So this is a game, particularly in biology or medicine, where you're limited by the tools. And the real heroes are the people that make new tools, because they're the ones who enable other people to see beyond. So this was the point of Brenner's quote. And that's about it. I'll take questions now. Thanks.